is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Yes, of course, it's still Tuesday because we're Zooming, but you know, it's life when you're isolated. Anyway, before we begin our show and our first guest, let me remind you that you will hear the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman when he was testifying during the impeachment hearing of 2019. You may be getting bored of it. I don't know how you can. I hope it touches you emotionally. It still touches me every time I hear it. But the most important thing is you need to have his voice ringing in your ears when you go to vote in November of 2020. Now the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
ProPublica, what a fabulous site. Let me just say something. What a fabulous site. There are certain places I go to on a regular basis. Ken Barnes will tell you absolutely she does this. And I went to ProPublica and I saw two interesting articles. They dealt with contact tracing. Now, I think I know what it is. I hear it a lot. I keep hearing two things all the time. Testing, contact tracing. Testing, contact tracing. Well, testing I get, you know. Contact tracing, maybe not so much. So I realized, you know what? If I'm still sort of curious about it, I suspect so are you. Caroline Chen is joining us. She writes for ProPublica. Her resume is unbelievable. So Ken, let me share it with you. Caroline Chen covers healthcare for ProPublica. Previously, she worked at Bloomberg News, where she wrote about the Valeant Pharmaceuticals' use of a mail order pharmacy to boost reimbursements for its drugs. The tactics used by a rare disease drug maker to, quote, scare patients into staying on therapy, and the plight of medically complex babies who get stranded in hospitals because of a lack of home care nurses. She received her master's degree from the Stabile Program in Investigative Journalism at Columbia University, where she was awarded a Pulitzer Traveling Fellowship. Boy, I'd like that. Anyway, let me welcome Caroline to the program. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to join you today.
Well, I'm really happy that you're here. And I didn't want to make an assumption that I understood contact tracing because I knew sort of like a two-sentence definition. And therefore, the two pieces that you wrote, I thought were so incredibly helpful. One was, you don't need invasive tech for successful contact tracing. Here's how it works. And then the other one, which I thought was even in some ways interesting, perhaps to be for me if I need a job in the fall, do I know enough to get a job as a contact tracer? So that's par deux. Let's start with part one. They keep talking about that, about this. They keep saying that this really is the essential piece with testing to really open up this economy and do it safely. So I'm gonna step back and say, Caroline, what the hell is it? And how do I know how to respond if someone calls me and says, by the way? So there's just all these questions. And I thought if you could hold our hand and explain to us a little bit about what it is and then what it does, we will have a better handle on what might happen if we get that phone call that says someone that you know has tested positive.
Yeah. And I love that you started off by saying, hey, hang on a second, what is it actually? Because I was actually in your shoes. One of my colleagues suggested to me, I've been doing a series of columns that sort of are deep dives into topics that are confusing or complicated as we go through this pandemic. And one of my colleagues said to me, hey, why don't you do a column on contact tracing? And I, like you, was like, well, we know what that is. And then I started thinking about it. And I was like, do we actually know what that is? And I think people do have sort of this hazy understanding of what it is. And as I started thinking about it, I was like, well, okay, hang on a second. Who actually counts as a contact? What actually goes into this? And I started writing out a list of questions, started asking my colleagues. I was like, hey, what would you want to know? And it turned out that there were a lot of questions. So I was like, all right, you're right. I should get into this. So let me back up a little bit here.
Caroline.
Yeah.
Let me just say one quick thing. And that is that the reason I love your article is that it's not only what is it, it understands from the perspective of someone like me who may never be a contact tracer, but might get the phone call. And that is important. We need to educate the public, not only on what does it do, but educate the public on what happens when you get the call.
Yeah, exactly.
I think this is so important because I want people to be responsive. I want them to understand why it's important. And that's why your two pieces together are fabulous.
Yeah. So as it turns out, contact tracing is not new at all. So it's been around for decades and decades. I was trying to figure out like what was the earliest instance of use of contact tracing. And I found it's probably earlier than this, but in the United States in the 1930s, it was used to help contain a syphilis outbreak. So it's been around for a long time and it's very effective. It was used to great success to help contain the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. And the reason why I think it's important to keep this in mind is because I think in this current coronavirus outbreak, there's been a lot of attention been paid, we'll talk about this later, to the digital apps and like flashy technology. And also a lot of attention, rightfully, I think, been given to, you know, how South Korea has done it. But, you know, people have the sense of like, it has to be super high tech. And that is not true. It's like a long-standing public health tool that has been used for decades and decades and actually goes on to this day. If there's a tuberculosis case in America, public health silently and quietly behind the scenes does contact tracing. And the reason you don't realize it is because when it's done well and it's done professionally, it's not like out there in public. They don't put up billboards. Like it just happens over the phone quietly and professionally and anonymously. So what happens with, so contact tracing very basically involves public health professionals calling someone who is known to have tested positive for a disease and asking them, who are you in touch with? And then they take whatever appropriate action is needed to ask the contacts and the person who was infected to do whatever is needed to, they call it breaking the chains of transmission. And whatever appropriate action depends on what type of disease it is. So if it's a sexually transmitted disease, obviously you don't need to ask the person to like stay at home and have groceries delivered to them. In this case, it is a respiratory disease that, as we know, can be quite contagious. So in the case of the coronavirus, you do have to ask people to stay at home and have no contact with other people, right? So that is the appropriate action to break the chains of transmission. So what's going to happen when you get a call depends on which bucket you're in. You're either someone who is confirmed positive, right? So you're a patient, or you're someone who is a contact. So if you get a call and you're someone where we already know that you've tested positive, they're going to call you and say, hey, so we're going to, two things. One, they need to help you figure out how long you need to stay at home for. And that's going to depend on your symptoms and how quickly they resolve. So they're helping you calculate that time period of isolation. And then the second thing that they're doing, this is where they get that term contact tracing, is they're trying to figure out who your close contacts were. And they sometimes call it disease detectives. And the reason why they have that term disease detectives is you might know the names of some of your contacts, right? Like obviously like people you live with, people you work with, like you'll know those names, but you might be like, well, I had this long conversation for like 20 minutes with Bob at the grocery store, but I don't know Bob's last name. I don't know his phone number. Exactly. And so then the contact tracer.
That's what I was thinking about. I mean, I don't know everyone. Everyone knows me. I don't know them. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Arnie, like, Arnie, oh you're God. Famous. Well, you're yeah, famous. People don't know, you don't know everybody, right?
Exactly, so. Exactly. And I'm terrified because I kept thinking, when they said, who have you associated with? I'm like, oh.
Right.
How do you respond to that when you're not sure of the names? You may know a location. You may remember the time, but you sure as heck don't necessarily know the people that you actually had that conversation with.
Exactly. So that's their job. So they have all these tricks where they'll say, like, let's look through your calendar. Like, do you remember what you were doing that day? And they'll help you sort of go through your day. And so, as I mentioned to you, I realized I didn't know what a contact was. Like, is a contact like somebody you're with for 5 minutes? Is it somebody you just talked to briefly? So it turns out that there's an actual definition. And this is, you know, worked out now based on what we know of the disease and its transmission. It's been refined over time. So at this point in time, the CDC has decided that a close contact is someone that you've been in within 6 feet distance of for more than 15 minutes, within 2 days before your symptoms began. So that's the definition. I'll repeat it one more time. 6 feet distance for more than 15 minutes, starting 48 hours or 2 days before your symptoms began. So there's a limited time window. And it's not like if I, you know, brushed by someone, you know, briefly on the street, they're a contact, you know. So they will work through with you to help figure that out. And as I said, if I'm like, well, I talked to Bob at the grocery store for 15 minutes, you know, they will call the grocery store. And remember, there's a privacy element to this. They will not tell the grocery store that it was Caroline who was sick. They'll just say, you know, we know of a positive patient, you know, who was in touch with someone at your grocery store. Do you have someone who, you know, a Bob who works in the produce section? And that's why they're called disease detectives.
So let me ask a question, because this is, I'm so glad you're on the air with me, because there was a story that just broke this week. And again, from a contact tracing perspective, I'm trying to figure out how to sort of fit the pieces that you're just describing to me into this scenario. So mm-hmm. we have a state liquor store, okay? We have lots of state liquor stores. And up until about maybe a week and a half ago, not only that, the employees at the state liquor store did not have to wear masks. They now do, but about a week and a half ago, they did not. And it turns out that the people that come and shop at the state liquor store do not. It turns out that one of the employees at the state liquor store was COVID positive. And it happened about a week ago. But they didn't tell anyone that it happened. And about a week later, they shut down this little, you know, liquor store in Manchester. So my question is that I don't know how long that person may have talked to the person who was buying the booze. It might have been only a couple of minutes. It might have been a long time, because they could have been buying cases of Hennessy for all we know, which is not uncommon at our liquor stores. So I'm just trying to figure out what would have been the appropriate response given contact tracing. Would you have wanted people to know immediately that an employee at our liquor store tested positive? If you shopped at this liquor store, you know, 2 days before and on that day, let us know. What would that detective do? Or is even the detective appropriate given that this is sort of a sale situation and it's not necessarily 15 minutes? But then again, how do we know? Because when someone's confused about the kind of scotch they want to buy, they may do it for 15 minutes.
Right. So what I was told by, you know, so I talked to a number of people who have done this work on the ground, including the chief of the, they call it the EIS service, which I think is the Epidemiological Intelligence Service at the CDC, which is quite a mouthful here. First, I will caveat this by saying every public health department does this case by case, and they're going to make a call, you know, case by case, depending on the setting. You know, if it was a tiny, tiny little store, really cramped with poor ventilation, they might make a different call here. So I cannot tell you specifically, you know, what is the right answer for that scenario you just told me. However, I will try to give you some like broad parameters. And again, I'll say, you know, the public health department might make a different call with that specific.
That's fine. The broad parameters at least gives me a handle.
I think that there was this emphasis where they told me that there was this emphasis on anonymity and privacy. So, you know, I feel like it would be very surprising to me if in any situation they would say announce the name of that employee, right?
Absolutely.
So there was this desire to this sense that, you know, you want to maintain privacy of that employee. I do think that I imagine, you know, especially with people paying with credit cards nowadays, that there would be a log of who had paid. So they might be able to just call people, you know, on the, on, you know, within that window of 2 days before that person became symptomatic. Remember that you can test positive even before you become symptomatic. And the CDC's definition is 2 days before you start displaying symptoms. So it could be that it's a smaller window even that there's concern, but they could say, all right, maybe 2 days before this employee tested symptomatic, we're going to call everybody who came to that store because the employee cannot remember how long they interacted with each person. And we're just going to call everybody in those 2 days a contact. So depending, again, on the situation of that store and how good that employee's memory is and how many people it is, the public health department is going to make a decision on who they consider a contact. So we haven't talked about what happens when you're a contact.
Yeah, that's
so we should probably talk about that because That's most of us, right?
Yes.
So you'd get a call from the public health department. And again, as we've talked about, they're not going to tell you who it is you came in contact, but they'd say, you know, we have information so that you were, you know, in contact with someone who was COVID positive. And there the CDC standard is presuming you don't develop symptoms, they want you to be in quarantine for 2 weeks. And I think something that came across really strongly to me in all of my interviews was how important it is that you're ready to support someone that you're going to ask to be in quarantine for 2 weeks. You can't just be like, hey, like, now we need you to stay at home for 2 weeks, because somebody might be the only breadwinner in their family. They might not be able to have groceries delivered to them. You know, they might, you don't know what situation people are in. So public health needs to be working with social services. They need to have, this word came up in every interview I did, and I interviewed a lot of people for this story, which was the word trust. And there was this, if you don't mind me telling you a really quick story here.
No, please, please, this just enhances the conversation.
So I talked to Dr. Raj Punjabi, who is the CEO of Last Mile Health, which is a nonprofit that works with remote communities. They started out in Liberia and now work with a number of different countries. And he was telling me about how contact tracing worked in the Ebola epidemic in West Africa in Liberia. And he told me the story of this woman who got very sick with Ebola. She was in the city and she couldn't find a bed. So she did, you know, what I think a lot of us instinctively do, which is she wanted to go back home to her family to die. And so she left the city and went like into the rainforest and went home to her family and died. And then a bunch of people went to her funeral and then they all got sick with Ebola. And there were like 21 cases of Ebola, of people sick. And they realized that if they didn't get on it, it would just start spreading in that very remote village community. And what the Ministry of Health did is they sent out a bunch of nurses. So these are trained professionals, and they hired people in the community to be contact tracers. And they paired basically neighbors of the sick people with the nurses, paired them up and asked them to go do contact tracing. And he said it was critical that they hire people in the community to do this work, because you don't trust people who come in from the outside and give them your information. It's, why would you tell them this?
Exactly.
Very personal information. And so this was sort of a theme that came in over and over again, which is as we build up, hire a lot of people to do contact tracing, it's really important to have input from the community. And so this kind of brings me to that second article, which I kind of wrote as a quiz, but I think it's not just about like gathering data. I think the hardest part of being a contact tracer is honestly building up this trust with the person you're calling and being able to say, I'm asking you to do this hard thing. Please stay home.
Well, so this is really interesting. So I'm going to ask you another stupid question.
No question is stupid.
No. What exactly is quarantine?
Oh, this is so, I mean, there's so much jargon going on right now.
No, I want people, again, we don't really define terms. And I think definition matters, because I think people need, you're saying, how do I ask someone to quarantine for 14 days?
What does
quarantine mean? Staying in my bedroom? What does quarantine mean? I mean, that's what I'm kind of curious. define quarantine.
Okay, let me define some terms here. And it's really funny to me because scientists and researchers are always so precise. And I'm like, I understand you want to be precise because these are the terms you use in your work, but like you're not explaining them to anybody. So there are two terms you'll hear a lot. You'll hear the words isolation and you'll hear the words quarantine.
Yes.
Isolation is the word that they use when someone is already a patient, someone who is COVID positive. And quarantine is the word that they use for someone who is still healthy contact who has not yet tested positive. And people get all sort of like nitpicky and they're like, oh, you're using the wrong word for the wrong person. Like if you say quarantine a patient or isolate a contact, they're like, you're using the wrong word for the wrong person. But in reality, from a practical standpoint, you're doing the same thing, which is you're isolating yourself from other people.
And that means that you have no contact with anyone, that you have food delivered to you, that you sort of stay within the confines of whatever the space is.
Basically, don't share a bathroom, don't share living space.
Okay.
Have food delivered to you.
About that too. So right now, this is great. Right now, we just started allowing anyone to be tested.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to have a doctor's recommendation. You don't have to show any kind of signs. You could just call up convenient MD or whatever it is and you can get a test, okay? So if that's the case, you know, we're being told, for example, we're opening up for business, but we want you to quarantine for 14 days if you decide to come to a hotel or an Airbnb or whatever, or go camping or whatever.
Right.
Well, would that still be necessary if now anyone can access a test? And, you know, it may take them 48 hours to find out whether they're COVID positive or not, and they'll quarantine for that time frame. But once they get the test back and the test says you're negative, do you still require people to quarantine for 14 days? So as you're doing this tracing, you're saying to someone, well, this is my concern, but does that person still have the ability to access a test and then find out, well, I may have had contact, but that contact didn't necessarily infect me?
Wow, that is an interesting and very smart question, which I have not done a ton of reporting on. So I'm going to caveat this with, I'm going to start by saying, I don't know.
Okay. That's perfectly fine, but this is an important question.
It's an important question. I think
more testing. Go on.
I think the tricky part to this is you then are presuming that the test is 100% accurate, right? And I think the question is, you know, what percentage of potential false results are you allowing to slip through? Because now I do think, you know, in the case that say, there's a difference here between someone who's saying like, you know, I'm traveling to a hotel and, you know, I'm able to, you know, presume at some point we have tests that we can just like mail to us or whatever. And I have no reason to think that I was in contact with a positive patient, you know. And I can test myself and prove that I'm negative. I think your chances there, it's a much lower chance that you were positive in the first place.
Right.
And then if you have the added assurance of a test showing that you are negative, I think, you know, you can live with a very small chance of the test being inaccurate.
So Karen, as we're talking about I'm getting the sense that we talk about trust, and trust is really important. So you're going to get a phone call, and someone's going to sort of say something to you that's going to scare the hell out of you.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and then what it sounds like is really important is that once you have this conversation and you suggest to someone that they're going to have to quarantine, what kind of follow-through happens in the 14 days?
Oh,
how many
times
do they get called back? Is there a physician that's assigned? Do they say, do they ask you questions like, do you need help with your groceries? Do you need help?
Yeah, absolutely.
So
as I said, they will definitely make sure that you're supported and able to either, you know, isolate or quarantine, depending on whatever category you're in. And then, as I said, if you're sick, they have to help you calculate, depending on your symptoms, when you are able to safely leave. So they check back up on you frequently to monitor your symptoms. And then if you are a contact, presuming you're healthy at the beginning, you have no symptoms, they're checking back in on you to see if you're developing symptoms, right? Because if you start developing symptoms, then they're going to say, it seems like you might need to go get tested. And then they're going to figure out a way for you to safely go get tested. So it's a lot of work. And this is why states need to hire so many people, because there is this constant need to be checking back in on people. And I think this is also another reason why I think even as we start opening back up, we cannot suddenly start going to football games or like crowding in bars, because that brings the average number of contacts per person up a ton, which then creates a lot of work. I think this, a lot of the models I've seen, and I've linked to this in the story if anybody wants to go look at, presumes like an average of 20 to 30 contacts per person. And that keeps it at still sort of a manageable level, even if we, you know, presuming we hire a ton of people. This is not presuming 100 contacts per person in sort of like a football game scenario, you know? Right. So I think.
And so I'm going to have to let you go. I should have had you on for an hour. So one of the things I think is interesting. So I'm going to assume that everyone that tests positive will then have a conversation with a contact tracer.
Mm-hmm.
And then the contact tracer. So one of the reasons why you don't want to have a lot of positives is that you have, that means you have that many more people that you have to hire. And you're not just hiring them for that one phone call, you're hiring them to sort of be, sort of massage the next 14 days with each person that they're, you know, being in touch with. And it sounds overwhelming, but it sounds like it's essential if we're gonna open safely, especially if we're looking at opening schools and everything else in the fall.
Absolutely.
Right. And Arnie, could I just say, I think, Arnie, the point you just made is critically important, because I think it's the cost of having to do what we have to do to be really safe that makes people want to look the other way, especially President Trump. You know, it's the word you used, Arnie, as well. We don't want to have too many positive tests, because if we do, we're going to have to do a lot of tracing. Well, the fact is that we need to have a lot of tests, and everyone is positive. We need to have a lot of contact tracing. It's going to cost a lot of money, and that's the way it is, Donald.
Yeah.
But Caroline, that one thing that's so interesting to me is, but that's why when you see them, you know, not social distancing at pool parties, or you see them at birthday parties, you're like apoplectic. And it's because every time you see that, what you realize is if you're going to be a contact tracer, you just exponentially created a number of people that potentially are going to need to be contacted. And here's the question. You don't contact everyone at the pool party, do you? Do you wait till someone at the pool party tests positive for COVID, and then you call the entire pool party?
Right. Okay. Now, I do want to say, though, we've talked a lot about like people staying at home here, and I think the one thing that I would want people to keep in mind is ultimately the goal of all of this is to allow us to reopen the economy safely. Yes. And the goal of all of this is, if you do get the call, is to keep in mind, like, I am staying at home so that the other 90-something percent of people can be out, and so that the economy can be open and we can all go back to work. And like, by my staying at home, other people can be out. And so we don't have to do what we have been doing, which is having 90% of people stay at home.
Right. And again, if we look at all these pieces, it is the testing, it is the contact tracing, it is the distancing of 6 feet, it's the wearing of the masks, it's washing of the hands. Believe it or not, none of these are hard. We're not asking people to learn how to, you know, use an Uzi. We're not asking people to learn how to like go under barbed wire. We're not asking, I mean, everyone keeps talking about this being a war. This is really, from a war perspective, this is not that difficult. We're not going into the basement to shelter ourselves from the bombs. All we're asking people to do is put on a damn mask and wash their hands. You know, it's like, I mean, people are thinking, oh my God, how can you ask me to do this? Well, I'm asking you to do this so that the contact tracing that we do is not overwhelming us, because we've actually behaved more appropriately. Caroline Chen, you are phenomenal. You're a great writer and you're a really good storyteller. So thank you so much. And I recommend everyone go to ProPublica. Why? Because you have to read both articles, not only about you don't need invasive tech for successful contact tracing, here's how it works, or so you want to be a contact tracer. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. All right, bye.
Pleasure, ciao, bye-bye. All right, everyone, stick around. We'll be right back. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Greenland, an island more than three times the size of Texas, is largely covered by a massive sheet of ice. It's more than a mile thick in most places. But as the climate warms, the Greenland ice sheet is starting to melt faster than it can be replenished by wintertime snow. Twyla Moon is a research scientist at the Colorado-based National Snow and Ice Data Center.
We're seeing more and more consistently years of very high ice loss, something really that humanity has never seen before.
And the trend could continue. In a recent study, researchers at the University of Alaska Fairbanks studied what will happen if carbon pollution continues to increase over this century. They found that within 1,000 years, the entire ice sheet would likely melt, causing seas to rise between 17 and 23 feet. But Moon says the world can't avoid that future.
The difference between following a very aggressive path of action in reducing greenhouse gas emissions versus what we're doing today is quite truly the difference between losing all of the Greenland ice sheet or keeping the vast majority of it. That's all just a matter of human action. What we do will be the primary determinant of what things look like in the future.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Change, change, change. Change, change, change.
Of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I love the title, Sludge. How I feel sometimes when I'm covering politics is that I've got my arms up to my armpits in sludge. And I'm always kidding people that I love to garden. And why do I love to garden? Because I'm putting my hands into clean dirt as opposed to the kind of stuff I cover on the radio. So with that, we're going to introduce you to the co-founder of Sludge, David Moore, previously worked as the director of the nonprofit Participatory Politics Foundation, creating free and open source technology for civic engagement. PPF's flagship website, the Congressional Transparency Resource Open Congress, received 70 million page views between 2007 and 2013, with hundreds of thousands of users tracking bills. So as I'm thinking about this, it sounds like the most important things that you value at Sludge is transparency. And the opposite of transparency, I think, is sludge. So it's totally appropriate. So okay. David, I looked at a couple of articles that you wrote at your site. And the one that caught my eye is the one that has so frustrated me about the Democratic Party. When I ran for governor, it was in 1992. It was the year of Bill and Hill. And I do need to tell you, I didn't really know what a new Democrat was. I'd never really met one before. Well, that was probably maybe not surprising. But what I knew about Bill Clinton was that as I was running for governor, he was running for president. And I would open up rooms because more people would come to see me because I was a better known figure. He was like, you know, third string Bubba from Arkansas. So he would walk into a room and without fail, what always amazed me, because remember, he was a Democrat, was that under one arm was the banking lobbies, and under the other arm was the insurance lobbyists. And I remember at one point, I called my staff and I said, so who the H is this Clinton guy? I mean, he's got the people that I've been fighting for like 7 years under each arm. And they went, you know, I'm really not sure, Arnie, we're literally focused on your gubernatorial campaign. Well, fast forward. Now you understand the repeal of Glass-Steagall. Now you understand, you know, the deregulation of derivatives. Now you understand all of this. And I saw it, but I didn't compute. I didn't compute. So that was 1991 and 1992. Has it gotten better? Maybe not. Here's the title of your article. Here are the corporate lobbyists on the DNC committee that blocked the climate debate. And actually, you spent a lot of time looking at the DNC and all the sort of corporate connections between Tom Perez and obviously large wealthy interests. And it doesn't surprise me, it just exhausts me. So why don't you share with our audience a little bit about the kind of work you've done at Sludge and let people know who these individuals are. And maybe the saddest thing about all of this is that not only do these people influence the DNC via Tom Perez, but there is so little transparency. And here's the Democratic Party out of one side of their mouth screaming for transparency. And then when you look at how the DNC operates, transparency, that's for other people. So welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Arnie. That's a very on-point introduction. I'm really grateful to share some of our reporting. So Sludge is an independent investigative newsroom, and all of our articles are free to read, so everyone can check out the articles in our DNC series and more at readsludge.com. And we're on social media, and we love hearing from readers. And the goal of this series was exactly as you put it, to uncover some transparency with who runs the DNC, what their affiliations are, what their potential conflicts of interest are, how they're paid, and then to try to wrap it up for greater accountability of how does the party enforce or not its own ethics rules. And a lot of this goes back to the reforms that came out of the contested 2016 primary that were put forward in a process called the Unity Reform Commission in 2017, where representatives from the former Clinton and Bernie Sanders campaigns negotiated some compromises on how the party would be slightly more accountable and open going forward. But while this was happening, this relatively recently elected chair, Tom Perez, was also using his levers of power at the DNC to install people on top committees who had backgrounds in corporate lobbying or corporate law or corporate consulting. And as well, the centralization of power within the DNC, the national party, really continues to reside just with the chair, where it all starts at the top with Tom Perez, and there's very little checks and balances on his decision-making. With this reporting series, then, on who really runs the DNC, our newsroom Sludge is taking a look at the four standing committees of the DNC, whose memberships had not been reported before. So one of the things that this series does first is it names the names of the corporate lobbyists, lawyers, and consultants who are on the key committees that are a gatekeeper to the larger party. And in documenting their ties to corporate lobbyists and corporate clients with the fossil fuel industry, the banking industry, the defense sector, and more, we found that there's a far greater number of individuals with backgrounds in advancing corporate interests who are sitting on the key committees of the DNC than had been previously aware. And this, crucially, that this information is not available online. You cannot find it on Democrats.org. You cannot find it on any official party website. Bits and pieces of it live on state party websites where sometimes they'll display their national members. And Wikipedia has a page that you can search for using the keyword of the Democratic superdelegates. But that's a long list that does not have all the context that our reporting series on Sludge has. So I'm excited to then go into some of the specifics.
Right. Let's go back to where you kind of started, which was that there was this negotiation between the Sanders people and the Clinton people in 2017. Mm-hmm. Bernie had to know that the potential for what you're describing could be the result. Wasn't there a request by the Sanders campaign for transparency that, you know, if you're going to give Tom Perez so much power, probably not a good idea, but if you're going to give it to him, one of the requirements of giving it to him is that you have to show me, you know, mm-hmm. I need to see this stuff. It seems so shocking to me that one of the first things I would have asked if I were Bernie was, okay, but I want to know everyone. I want to know their background. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to connect the dots. How could Tom Perez have gotten away with this, given the fact that one of the reasons Bernie was negotiating with Hillary was to sort of bring his people power transparency agenda mm-hmm. to the DNC? You would have thought that they heard that. Or did they hear it and then shelve it?
You got it, because it was a contested issue in the process that was called the Unity Reform Commission, where several different parties came together for a series of very sort of opaque and in some ways very, very arcane negotiations about whether or not the party would open up its rules going forward. I think my characterization in response to your question is that many of the transparency and ethics measures were not adopted, but the one reform of the party that was adopted was that in 2020, what's called superdelegates, which includes many corporate lobbyists, are not allowed to vote on the first ballot for the presidential nominee if no candidate receives a majority of the votes. So that was, so the superdelegate reform voting on the first ballot, that was the thing that did pass as, and then was in late 2017, and then was certified at the summer meeting by all the members of 2018 in a very strange and rushed sort of voice vote process that still hasn't been enshrined in the DNC charter itself. So that's an interesting wrinkle to all of this, that looking ahead to the convention, whatever the convention is going to be this summer, enshrining that reform in the party charter is going to be really interesting.
So what I'm hearing is we were like elated. Look what we did with the superdelegates. So we're all looking over here. And as we're all looking over here, that stuff that you're telling me about all those sort of corporate lobbyists and corporate lawyers and all that, and the lack of transparency, that was also happening, but on a parallel track. But we were all focusing on superdelegates as if they were the only Darth Vader in the Democratic National Committee. But it turns out that we didn't just want to know about the superdelegates. We probably also wanted this idea of transparency so we would understand what Tom Perez was doing. Because as you point out in one of your articles, of all the things not to allow with a presidential debate would be climate change. I mean, you would think that that would have been, you know, like a no-brainer, but Tom Perez never allowed a climate change official debate. And I think a lot of people were incredibly shocked, especially if you want to appeal to young people.
Right.
Especially we're looking at, you know, what's happening to Miami going underwater and California burning. And I mean, and the ice caps melting. You would think that this is a conversation we should have. But it turns out that the people around him wanted to make sure that that didn't become part
of it. You're right that the reformers among the Unity Reform Commission were pushing for greater transparency and ethics measures in the DNC. And so that would include things like including a financial oversight board within the DNC that was not controlled and appointed by the chair, Tom Perez, but still was able to audit and review the efficacy of the party's multimillion dollar contracts, of which there are many, almost 100 contracts above the level that need to be approved by the DNC Budget and Finance Committee. And then you bring up the very acute example of the climate change debate, which is a situation where you had youth protesters, environmental groups, some of the, you know, the legacy, you know, groups that are nationally known, the Sunrise Movement, youth climate protesters. The presidential candidates were generally all on board, almost all of them, led by, you know, initially kicked off by the campaign of former Governor Inslee, and Democrats favored it by a supermajority. And all of this did not come together to have a climate debate where the candidates would be multiple candidates on stage questioning each other about their plans. Somehow, this was not enough for Tom Perez to go forward with this proposal for a multi-candidate debate. And instead, it was watered down sort of unilaterally by Tom Perez coming out of the chair's office to be the town halls, which did not offer the same opportunity for a back and forth that a debate would have had. And then later, Tom Perez did change the debate qualifications unilaterally to allow Mike Bloomberg to make the debate stage, even though he didn't, you know, raise any small donor donations for his presidential campaign. So that's an example of how there's the checks and balances of accountability of the DNC. It doesn't follow any of the mentions of ethics in its own charter, and its policies are below the standard that would be set by a private or a publicly traded corporation.
Okay, so give me the names of some of these people that would have influenced. Now, remember, it's not just that these people would influence Tom Perez. My understanding is Tom Perez actually sort of chose these people. So it's not like, right, so this isn't like they were just put there in front of him. It was like he knew they were coming because he kind of wanted them there. So there's this sort of mutual relationship here. So I can't say, oh, the poor guy. What I'm going to say is he knew exactly what he was doing.
That's exactly right. So Tom Perez put forward a number of individuals with corporate backgrounds to be at-large DNC members. The at-large members are not individually elected and they're not accountable to any constituency. They're put forward as a slate by Tom Perez in a process that's never documented anywhere. And some of the individuals that Tom Perez put forward in October of 2017 in a purge that included a couple of New Hampshire's DNC members as well, included, you know, one was Harold Ickes, who's a lobbyist, who's got clients that include many well-known corporations, In addition, Joanne Dowdle, Fox okay, News sure. Corp lobbyist.
Tell everyone what Joanne does. I think this is important. I remembered, I had forgotten until I read your article.
Government Affairs for News Corp, which is the Murdoch-owned, used to be Fox News and now split off. And Joanne Dowdle was on the resolutions committee that voted against holding a climate debate. And here I have got Harold Ickes, some of the lobbying consultants included Verizon, Northwell Health, United Airlines, and a mining company. So there's plenty of fossil fuels involved there.
Do we know what the vote was on this? Because I mean, obviously this was required or requested. Tom Perez couldn't just say no. He had to have said, you know, I consulted and this was the vote of the committee. Were you then able to not only get the vote, but then told who voted which way?
Great question. The first step in the process was that the resolutions committee had to consider it in order to determine whether or not to make a recommendation to the full DNC members. The committee vote was 17-8 against holding a climate debate. And it was a little more, if folks can check my most recent DNC article, because there's a detail about how the Washington State Chair, Tina Podlowski, sought to bring up the climate debate resolution. So there's a little wrinkle in the in-committee procedure. But it was 17-8, and of the 17, 10 of the votes against it were directly appointed by Tom Perez. And it includes a couple of individuals with backgrounds in the fossil fuel industry. One, for example, is Charlie King, who's a lobbyist at a large firm called Mercury Public Affairs that's got oil and gas industry clients. They've got a client that's drilling in the Gulf of Mexico right now. And Charlie King, a member from at-large DNC member, voted against it. As well, you've got the former big money pioneer of the 1980s, Representative Tony Coelho, who championed in the 1980s as a DCCC chair, championed corporate PAC fundraising, voted against it. Simone Sanders, the senior advisor to the Biden campaign, in some ways was a very public-facing member, saying that this could be that holding a climate debate would damage the party because it would allow for antagonisms to surface, and voted against holding a climate debate. And as well, there's lots of other ties to the fossil fuel industry through the DNC that include the DNC's top law firm, Perkins Coie, which received multi-million-dollar contracts from the party and lots of other national democratic organizations, and is a fossil fuel lobbyist as well. And other consultants, including the firm Dewey Square Group, have members placed on the Rules Committee and on the Budget and Finance Committee, and the Rules Committee, certainly, corporations that do a lot of lobbying.
The names are going to sort of overwhelm people. What we have to know is that they're all sort of have some sort of corporate influence and sort of corporate responsibility, and it's not surprising that where they came from then resulted in a vote that said, no, we're not going to have a climate debate. So as I'm listening to you, I got a couple of questions. One is that, are there going to be recommendations as we go into 2020 as to what we saw happen this time that needs to be addressed next time? And the idea of transparency and who gets to make these appointments and that these names need to become public. I mean, as I'm hearing you and the amount of power that Tom Perez has, you know what's going through my head? Inspector General and Donald Trump. That's what I want someone to put these two boxes next to each other and say, why do they feel similar? You know, I mean, they really do. As I'm listening to you, I am looking at what Tom Perez did, and I'm looking at what, you know, Donald Trump does, and I'm appalled at Trump, but frankly, I'm appalled at Perez, you know? And you can't be a party of transparency, and you can't be a party that talks about, you know, climate change, and then you find out that one of the first things you abandon is transparency, and you are in fear of climate change. Well, I'm afraid of climate change too, but I'm not afraid of not talking about it. You know, I mean, there's a difference in the kind of level of fear. So as you've been writing your pieces and you've been uncovering, like you're peeling an onion, I feel like, to sort of finally get these pieces together, is Sludge going to make a recommendation as we approach the convention this summer and be able to say, this is what happened. This can't continue. This is who they placed on. This can't continue. This level of transparency must be, because I will tell you, we all focused on the superdelegates and this was sort of going under the radar, but yet in the end, what went under the radar turns out to be incredibly powerful.
Mm-hmm. So with SLEDs, the best way that we can contribute is to highlight the commentary of government ethics experts. And so we've done that in one of our pieces. We have a quote from ethics expert Craig Holman, a Public Citizen. And as well, in the past, we've drawn on other groups that have expertise in this to signal that other organizations, whether nonprofits or for-profit companies, have procedures in place for the kind of transparency you suggest. Yes, in answer to your question, there will be a process around whatever the convention is going to be that was going to work on the party rules, as happens every 4 years. Now, of course, the convention process is up in the air, as we all know, due to the pandemic. So we'll be tracking this closely over the next couple months, and we'll all have to see what shakes up. But there are also special convention committees regarding rules and platform that pop up around the weekend before the convention, where certain DNC members are appointed to go. Interestingly, Tom Perez also appointed a couple of Bloomberg campaign surrogates to that. But anyway, though, now that's not effective anymore. And the Biden campaign will have the majority of members as of right now. So
as I'm listening to you, suddenly now I want to ask, well, everyone's focusing on who Joe Biden will pick for VP. I think I want to ask the question, so who will you choose for your DNC chair? And what are the values you're looking for? And what level of transparency do you accept? Because I think if you can get him on the record, so, you know, everyone is focusing on the VP, which is fine, but in the end, the DNC ultimately sort of sets a kind of interesting underbelly agenda for the party as it moves forward. And if you get Joe Biden to have to, I mean, Joe Biden has already said, I'm going to pick a woman, okay. Probably a woman of color. Okay, well, that doesn't tell me anything because, I mean, Joanne Dowdell, who represents News Corp, happens to be a black woman. So that it's not like just because you say a woman and a woman of color, you should assume that they're, you know, some progressive lefty because Joanne is not, you know? And so as I'm looking at this, I just want him to be able to be asked these questions, knowing what you've told me that happened as a result of the choice of Tom Perez. And that, I think, I mean, in some ways, what I would love from Sludge, it's a series of questions to be asked of Joe Biden and use those questions based on what you were able to expose about Tom Perez. Ken, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, David, this is just shocking to me, what you're talking about. And that really is only a testament to my naivete, even though I think I know so much and I'm following this so closely. And I'm wondering, are you advocating and can we together advocate for some kind of reform movement? I mean, like in 1900s, shed some light, let some fresh air in, open the windows on the Democratic Party. I mean, for crying out loud, shouldn't we have at least transparency, some kind of democracy? It's not just a matter of who's appointed to be chair and czar of this autocratic organization, but rather how does it work? And shouldn't it work in a way that members of the Democratic Party, people like us who vote, have some say in and can trust as something that, yeah, my party stands for democracy with a small d.
So Ken, that's a great question as well. The folks who are interested in connecting with groups that are active around party reform can Google the Unity Reform Commission and connect with the transparency advocates who included Dr. James Zogby nationally, Larry Cohn, and Nomiki Konst, and other names. And one step that individuals can take if they're, you know, in their own state parties is to see if their state website has a clear list of who their DNC members are, how to contact them, what they're up to, and ask them to disclose what committees they're on, and as well to see if they'll disclose sort of standard conflict of interests, potential, you know, noted within the party. So individuals can take steps within the state, and as well then they can online search around for terms like, you know, DNC members pro-transparency to connect with some of the members who are typically younger and are more in favor of a greater transparency. And Arnie, in response to your question about asking questions about personnel, I think is brilliant because that's gets at such a key power lever.
Let me say something. Elizabeth Warren's statement is going to be, I'm going to stitch it on my pillows. And she says, personnel is policy.
Personnel is policy.
Mm-hmm. I want everyone to hear that. That should be the mantra of the Democratic Party. And so as you ask Joe Biden a question, it's not because you want to do a gotcha. But if you understand that personnel is policy, then you have to ask these questions because his answers are going to tell you really where the result will go, you know? And that's why, as soon as we saw it was Tom Perez, you know, I started to twitch because I kind of knew what was going to happen. And now I find out that it was even worse than I knew, and that there was even less transparency than I knew. That this explains why there was no climate conversation between the candidates at a time when climate is really how you want to bring in, you know, so many young people. And it would be, to me, I want my party to be on the record. I don't want my party to run away from the record.
That's right. So folks, interested folks in following those issues can search for a project called the Revolving Door Project, of a DC nonprofit called CEPR. And in conjunction with the progressive group Demand Progress, they're starting to put forward lists of administration figures that they'd like to see involved in different advisor capacities. And DNC reform could be, you know, could be potentially an area that they could add to it. But the Revolving Door Project puts out a great newsletter with updates around some of those. So you're that looking at those same issues that you just highlighted, because nearly one third of executive committee members, over half of the rules committee members, and over half of the budget and finance committee members, our investigation found, are appointed by Tom Perez, not individually elected. So if the party seeks to be responsive to the grassroots and have a political ethics that reflects independence, more reforms are going to be needed to be put forward here in 2020.
And so David, the other thing is that you're talking about the lack of transparency, that this was hard to find. This information was not obvious. You right. have to use all your investigative skills in order to come up with names. Yeah. Names, and this is my party, not the Republican Party. I'm not asking for names, you know, with JP Morgan. I'm asking for the names of the Democratic National Committee and who's assigned to this and what's their background.
That's right.
You have to exercise so much effort just to dislodge this information. To me, speaks right. volumes about what needs to change.
That's right. Well, we got a copy of the list from a DNC member who gave us a copy with the committee affiliations, but then that required both additional checking and then lots of lobbying and corporate consulting research to find their affiliations.
So you had to have a whistleblower, in other words.
It helped move things forward to have a copy of who's on the what committees and who's an at-large member mm-hmm. from a DNC member who supported transparency.
Well, and I know I sounded a little crazy when I talked about the inspector generals, but as you were talking, that's all I kept thinking about, is that this feels and sounds so familiar. And I think in an interesting way, to even suggest that is to make people like Joe Biden very uncomfortable. And I want to make him very uncomfortable, because what we're finding out is that you don't want to give that kind of power to one person, that there needs to be a check on that power. And there needs to be, you know, some sort of oversight other than the people that are doing the investigation can now be, you know, replaced because Donald Trump has decided to do that. So I think in a lot of ways, not only do we see a change in the party, but because of Donald Trump, we now know that we really should demand these kinds of questions be asked, and that the answers really affect the kind of change that we can not only trust, but believe in. David Moore, thank you so much for doing this. ReadSludge.org or .com?
.com.
ReadSludge.com. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Oh, I hope you join us again.
Thank you.
All right. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. People.